Welcome to the Synthetic Media Podcast. I'm your host, Henrik DeCure. Join me for interviews and thoughts on the ever-expanding topic of synthetic media. You can find my book on synthetic media on Amazon. Subscribe to this podcast for free. Follow us on syntheticmediapodcast.com and enjoy today's episode.
My name is Joel Bellinson, and I'm, what do? I think I'm an explorer like everybody else. I explore my life and I explore the world, and I have used science and technology and and IT and business to explore it and try to make things that would help other people that want to explore the world. And I've been involved in a lot of technologies since very young. I was making, my own video games, in the 70s. And, did the whole, big name university crap, for chemistry and biology. And I got out and I ended up heading up the first and largest DNA synthesis and sequencing factories at Stanford University Medical. I left out before that. I did Carnegie Institution of Plant Biology and I became a genetic engineer there. So I got into the automation side of all of the research. And for me, I had a kind of a philosophical conflict with the reductionism, a genetic reductionism in particular. So I got very interested in trying to envision things as choreographies of many different participants, whether genes or proteins or what have you, and being able to look at their quantitative levels and their substructural things and getting an idea how they interact. And so, we ended up pioneering a lot of different categories, combining genotype with phenotype and gene expression and protein expression. And my company, I think, became most famous in the end for being the first to assemble and annotate the human genome. And we beat Craig Venter and every other country and company on planet Earth. And therefore, the human genome stayed in the public domain. We didn't file patents on any of it. And we allowed everybody to access it royalty free. We made money, but they paid subscription fees. And we weren't trying to reach around and grab their discoveries or make it difficult for someone who was too broke to be able to get access to the Book of Life. So that was kind of my thing. I felt like by giving out this Book of Life to everybody, it would really give people a chance to study and see what we learn from it, and what else, because we're going to always be learning what we don't know. And what we don't know is by definition infinite, right? And, we always flatter ourselves that we think we know everything. And I'm really all about acknowledging ignorance. And I when I moved here to Uganda, that was part of my mission statement to myself, that I'm going to value my ignorance of what is to come. And so I took this quote from Star Trek Deep Space Nine from Captain Sisko. And he says, "That may be the most important thing to understand about humans. It is the unknown that defines our existence. We are constantly searching, not just for answers to our questions, but for new questions. We are explorers. We explore our lives day by day. And we explore the galaxy, trying to expand the boundaries of our knowledge. And that is why I am here, not to conquer you with weapons or with ideas, but to coexist and learn." So that's been my mission statement since I've been here now for all these years. And that's just how I think I operate.
Joel, how are you involved with synthetic media?
Well, after Double Twist, we're kind of not quite after, before I, still in parallel, I guess, with Double Twist, I started DigiSense, also with Dexter Smith, my business partner and, and friend for decades. We were taking a vacation finally, right? We had brought on Fortune 500 management folks. And so now we could just be on the board of directors and chill for a while. And I was, chief strategist, and he had his, role of, head of all of integration, but it was like, still, we could chill finally for the first time in many years. And so we're hanging out in the beach in South Beach, Florida, and I'm surrounded by all these gorgeous women with their perfume and the jerk chicken, the smell of the ocean. And I was like, wow, I've been such a geek. I haven't gotten out into the world. I suck. But you know what? There must be a way to capture this experience and bring it to other people so that people could experience all kinds of places. And so that's what motivated me. And I was like, well, in the end, fragrance is all about just chemicals stimulating neurons at the receptors. And then somehow, we don't know, somehow it goes and gets wired into the brain. So that turns out to be a pretty complicated black box, and we don't know how it works. But it turned out that at least a girlfriend of a friend had just found the genes for the receptors for the sense of smell for mice and rats. She won the Nobel Prize for this, Linda Buck. And so I used her data, and we found the homologs in monkeys and in humans. And so we were able to model the scent receptors for them. And then, so we were going down that path of trying to model all that. And then in the end, I realized, in the end, whether or not we make this based, fully on the real biology is secondary for serving the entertainment or advertising purpose. And so let's just focus on the machine, and let's focus on recombining a well-defined set of, we'll call them primaries, but they, I'm not claiming they are, but like a color printer uses 4 color inks, we used 64 stinks, and using piezoelectric heads, just like on printers, we volatilized nanoscopic amounts of differing amounts of these 64 component fragrances to make thousands of fragrances. And we had our software synchronized with video games, with DVD movies, with websites. And so there was basically, we created the scent track for the first time. There would now be a possibility of a scent track, as well as, and there would be a new role in media of the scentographer. And so I'd like to think of myself as the first one to start to try to make this into a serious discipline of scentography. And so that's been my role. There have been other people who invented machines along the way. I'm not the very first. I think I was, better at mobilizing a lot of, well-regarded people. But other companies along the way, I'm sure, played their role in laying the path that I was able to follow on. But, it wasn't a heavy path. We were still pioneering, but I want to give credit wherever it's due, because I know people all around the world had filed patents about different ways of making machines to make smells. So I think many people wanted to do it. I think it's a human need, right, to communicate by any possible way, by music, by voice, by smell, by pictures. So it's just another one of our ways that we need to communicate in. Obviously, people do disrespectful things. They fart in each other's direction, to quote Monty Python. But, it's... so I think it's a basic human need to communicate. And I feel proud that I played a part in getting, really, getting started this field of scentography. And, you know, I'll be proud of that regardless of anything that ever happens. It's something I'm very proud of.
What are the biggest challenges and successes you've seen with synthetic media?
I remember very clearly how disappointed I was in the 1970s when the keyboard synthesizers weren't able to make accurate sounds of grand pianos. And that kind of bummed me out. I learned to appreciate that all these new crazy sounds it could make. And I got into all of the progressive rock because of it, you know, whether it was Yes or Queen or ELO or whatever, all, you know, Led Zeppelin, everybody used all kinds of synthesizers to make crazy stuff. So I embraced it, but it still felt separate and somehow less talented than the acoustic real instruments. And so I understand that tension, and I felt it even when we were dealing with the perfume companies between the, you know, the guys who are really trained noses versus us, you know, interlopers coming along with our computer, which is compared to their subtlety of the genius of their brains on the sense of smell. We were just cartoons, right? So I think a lot of synthetic media starts as a cartoon and then it becomes more, you know, realistic. And then the question is, how realistic do we truly want it to be? Because there is also the counter movement, right? People like anime, people like blatantly animated stuff, even though now we can do CGI that looks so real, you can barely tell that anybody apart. So it's interesting how, you know, at first every new synthetic media, I think, has to be a cartoon. And then over time it becomes more realistic. And then the question is, how much do we want realism versus how much do we like the cartoon versus just, is it about creating a mood or a style? And, but I think those are some of the questions, but that's art, right? That's an art question. And, you know, you can't dispute other people's tastes. They are what they are.
What advice would you like to share with people working on synthetic media now?
Well, synthetic media, obviously, we're hearing we're going to get Neal Stephenson's Metaverse given to us finally, 30 years, you know, after his book, you know, Snow Crash. So what is that going to mean? I think in general, we're going to have more and more difficulty telling reality from self-hallucination or deception by others. And as someone who lives in a country where there are scam artists of all colors, it can be very alarming to try to figure out truth from fiction in the real world. And there are people who are very clever at using this combination of synthetic reality and reality. And it's been, I mean, whether I like it or not, it's the genie is out of the bottle. And this is going to be a potent force in the universe. Same thing with genetic engineering, now that any 12-year-old can buy a CRISPR kit. So that's the new Legos. So we got people making incredibly sophisticated music. We're going to have people doing all kinds of, you know, synthetic realities where we see, you know, historical figures as if they're alive now, or people getting framed for things they never did, or all kinds of shit, you know, blackmail. I mean, the amount of, you know, people have good and bad in their hearts. And I just, let's pray that love wins.
Angel, where can we learn more about synthetic media and your work on the subject?
Well, my work on the subject, there was a beautiful article in Wired magazine in 1999. So I would advise people to do a search on Wired and DigiSense. And that was a nice article. The author visited my home. I gave him the very first demo of it. This was before we had shown anybody in the universe. But it's a nice article. So it gives you that moment, the first time someone got to experience the synthesizer. So yeah, I think just for as a beautiful article to read, Charles Platt did a wonderful job. And we were the cover story of Wired magazine, which is every geek's dream as much as it is for a musician to be on the cover of Rolling Stone, right? So I've had an incredible life. I've gotten to have my company be on the cover of Wired. So yeah, read that article.
Join us next week for a new episode by subscribing to the Synthetic Media Podcast. Check out my book about synthetic media on Amazon. Follow us on syntheticmediapodcast.com. This podcast was produced by Henrik de Gior. Music by Mattia Capelli. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. And thank you for listening.